folks, welcome back to Nadav Acker. This is Chris once again. Folks, welcome back to Indaba Africa News of the Day. This is Chris coming to you from central Pennsylvania. Welcome back, folks, to the Indaba Africa News of the Day. Today, the 6th of April, 2021. Let's get to our headlines as we go over news events for the day. Is it time to push back in Myanmar? Some activists are calling for demonstrators to push back against the military junta in Burma. Well, that may not be the wisest decisions, but that is the case. It wasn't me. No. We're not talking about Shaggy's famous song, "It Wasn't Me," creeping on the bathroom floor. No, it wasn't me. So says the suspected mastermind in the murder of eight or nine month pregnant woman who was murdered near Pretoria last year. Sefago Fatso Pule, who was murdered last year, brutally pregnant, hung from a tree. The purported mastermind is the father of her child, her unborn child, that was also murdered along with her in a double homicide. The South African Revenue Service has busted a diplomatic booze scheme in which diplomats from a number of countries were apparently purchasing alcohol and then selling it, defrauding the South African Revenue Service out of hundreds of millions of rand. Qatar Petroleum and Shell team up for oil exploration off the coast of Namibia. Interesting development there for oil exploration. Namibia has yet to exploit any significant oil or petroleum deposits. This could be promising news for the energy sector in Namibia. Meanwhile, in Namibia, President Kangab is launching yet another government agency, this one for tax collection. Kenya has ordered the United Nations to close two refugee camps, the Dadaab and Kakuna refugee camps, which together house over 400,000 refugees in northeastern Kenya. And a manhunt at this hour is underway in Nigeria after armed assailants busted into a prison, releasing 1,800 prisoners. Massive manhunt taking place in Nigeria at this hour. And Nigeria's educated are living hand to mouth, according to the Financial Times. Those are the headlines in today's abbreviated news report, folks. Let me get straight to a news analysis of those headlines. So Myanmar's military is waging war on its citizens. Some say it's time to fight back, according to Helen Regan, Kucha Ularn, Mike Phillips, and Ivan Watson of CNN. From a fenced-off compound close to the Myanmar border in northern Thailand, a rebel leader offers a bleak view of Myanmar's future as the country is cleaved apart by the military coup. The possibility of a deepening civil war in Myanmar is high, General Yadsek said from his administrative base in Chiang Mai province. The world has changed. I see people in the cities don't give up, and I see the coup leader, Min Aung Hlaing, won't give up. I think there is a possibility that civil war might happen. Yadsek is an old hand at confronting military rulers. He's chairman of the ethnic minority political organization Restoration Council of Shan State and founder of its armed wing, the Shan State Army, which controls large pockets of land in Myanmar's east. He is one of more than two dozen ethnic armed groups that have been fighting against the Myanmar military, known as the Tatmadaw, and each other since the country's borderlands for greater rights and autonomy, on and off for over 70 years. Since seizing power on the 1st of February, opposing the elected government of Aung San Suu Kyi, many of these rebel groups, including the RCSS, have expressed support for nonviolent nationwide protests against junta rule and condemned the indiscriminate brutality and use of force inflicted on Burmese civilians by junta-controlled soldiers. Well, I'm not certain that violence is the answer. I think that perhaps... not an optimist here, but some sort of genuine worldwide condemnation reaction, actual concrete action against the junta in Myanmar would be more appropriate. The silence of the Manchurian cadaver, the silence of the United Nations, the silence of Beijing, the silence of so many other actors is deafening as this military junta murders civilians in the streets. Where is the world over Cabo Delgado province? Busy looking at its navel? Trying to strip citizens of liberty around the world instead of focusing on the issues at hand? To think I can kill my own flesh and blood is nonsense. That's right, folks. To think I can kill my own flesh and blood is nonsense. That's what the suspected mastermind behind Ms. Pule's murder has said. The alleged mastermind behind the murder of Sefago Fatso Pule is applying for bail again in the Rota Port magistrates. Again, he's going to apply for bail. He's been out on bail. He told the court he cannot have killed his own flesh and blood nor the mother of his child. They have until April 22nd to respond. The alleged mastermind behind the murder of Sekefatso Pule said he's happy with the idea of becoming a father. He was happy and added that he would not have killed the deceased or his unborn child. She was 8 months pregnant with a child when she was killed in June of 2020. Her body found hanging from a tree in Rota Port. I can never imagine hiring someone I know to take a hit on the mother of my child, Ntukulo Shoba said in an affidavit. I do not have a child of my own, and to think that I can kill an innocent soul that is my own flesh and blood is nonsense at best, and I will challenge unlawful allegations. I could not have financially assisted the deceased through her pregnancy while in the meantime plotting to kill her. Shoba added in his affidavit, I submit that the police could have arrested me last year if there was anything incriminating me. However, they waited until Malapane made a plea bargain and or guilty plea in order to link me to the crime. I will further submit that I will strongly dispute any conspiracy to murder the deceased with Malapane, regardless of his misleading, untruthful, and dishonest plea. He added the deceased was his friend and that they had hooked up romantically for a brief period while he had separated from his long-term girlfriend. On June 4th, the deceased was at his house to compile a list of what they needed for their baby. Later that night, the deceased arranged her own ride home and walked her outside. When the vehicle arrived, it stopped a few meters ahead of him in Pule. She went to the front passenger door and knocked the window. She allegedly said to the driver, whose car is this? Look how drunk you are. Whatever the case, whoever murdered this young lady, it was a vile and disgusting act. 8 months pregnant, hung her from a tree. It got very little attention from the media. However, Chris Y in Africa reported on this extensively, on this brutal, sadistic murder of this 8-month pregnant mother. Expecting mother, I should say. We reported on it. And the South African Revenue Service has busted a diplomatic booze scheme, folks. Sorry, I'm laughing, but this one's almost too funny to believe. Having served as a diplomat in multiple countries, 8 countries across Africa and other places, I find this one unbelievable. Well, it's not that unbelievable. South African Revenue Service has uncovered a tax dodging racket in which foreign diplomats buy large volumes of alcohol at duty-free retailers and sell it locally, cheating the tax collector of an estimated 100 million in taxes every month. Wow, that's 1.2 billion rand per year. That is a lot of money, close to 100 million U.S. dollars. News 24 can reveal 2 investigations by SARS, one in 2019 and the other in 2020, which singled out diplomats from the U.K., Australia, New Zealand, from Rwanda, Lesotho, Ghana, Guinea, Malawi, and Burundi for being involved in the scheme. Now, how would this be possible? Well, folks, for those who don't know, diplomats are exempt from taxation. Virtually all taxation normally in a country. There are exceptions. Some things you just can't get around because the paperwork isn't processed properly. But normally, as you're a diplomat, you go to tax-free, duty-free stores to purchase things like alcohol and cigarettes. You can buy those there. If you buy them on the economy, you have to retain your receipt and then submit it. It takes months long. I mean, I left Botswana and I received a receipt for the value-added tax for things I purchased a year previously. Someone sent me the money who was still in Botswana that I knew. Otherwise, I never would have gotten the money. That's how far some of these countries can be in arrears in processing these things. But hey, it's Africa. What do you expect? I don't know how it is for diplomats in the U.S. because there's no national tax. So I don't know how it works if they're exempt from local state tax. But national value-added taxes and things like that, diplomats are exempt from. So you go to a specially designated store, in some cases only for the diplomatic community, and you purchase your alcohol, which is greatly discounted because there's no excessive tax applied to it. You're actually only paying for the product and what it costs for that business to make a little bit of money after all the costs associated with it. So it is not surprising to see diplomats from countries that are not particularly wealthy, and their diplomats obviously are not particularly well paid, to become engaged in a scheme to defraud the South African Revenue Service. This probably happens in many countries around the world. It's unfortunate. This is not a proper behavior for a diplomat. But part of the answer should be for governments to pay their diplomats sufficient funding to be there. If you can't afford a diplomatic mission, then you shouldn't send diplomats to that country. I'm just saying. And there you have it, folks. 100 million rand a month. 1.2 billion rand a year. That's $100 million. That's a lot of money, folks. Now, we were assured by President Cyril Ramaphosa recently when he spoke to the nation for his Easter address that South Africa had already secured 20 million doses of vaccine. Turns out that's simply not true. They've only now, after Easter, secured those doses. South Africa signed an agreement with Pfizer for 20 million dual-shot COVID-19 vaccine doses, a government official told Reuters on Tuesday. That's today, the 6th of April. Boosting plans to start mass vaccinations in April. The deal is another for the country worst hit by COVID infections in Africa, as it adds to the 31 million single-dose shots from Johnson & Johnson, which the government approved on Thursday. So that would make 51 million doses. Now, those 31 million are single shots, so why do you need this? I guess the 20 million to get 10 million and 10 million more, that would get you there. The government is buying Johnson & Johnson vaccines for $10 per dose. After the Pfizer deal, the government will have enough vaccine for roughly 41 million people out of its total population of 60 million. Now, let's do a little bit of math here very quickly, folks. Very, very quickly. There are going to be 31 million doses from Johnson & Johnson. That is $10 per dose that they're paying Johnson & Johnson. That's $310 million. Okay, are you with me so far? $310 million, okay. So that would be at current exchange rates, let's see, a total of how many billion rand? 4.65 billion rand. 4.65 billion rand. So let's see. The government received 90 billion rand from the African Development Bank, the BRICS Bank, and the International Monetary Fund in July and August of 2020. 90 billion rand. These doses cost just 4.6 billion to inoculate over half of South Africa's population with a single dose, which is all that's required with Johnson & Johnson. Where's all the money? Where has all the money gone? Meanwhile, Qatar Petroleum announced today that it's entered into an agreement with Shell to become a partner in two exploration blocks offshore from Namibia. Under the terms of the deal, which is said to be subject to customary approvals, Qatar Petroleum will hold a 45% participating interest in the PEL 39 exploration license in Block 2913 Alpha and Block 2914 Bravo. Shell will hold a 45% interest in the asset, and the National Petroleum Corporation will hold the remaining 10% stake. So there's no majority shareholder. That's interesting. PEL 39 blocks are located in ultra deep waters, about 8,200 feet, covering an area approximately 4,750 square miles. This is the company's second exploration license in Namibia. Well, petroleum has not been a resource that's been wildly exploited off the coast of Namibia to date. We shall see if that, in fact, can be the case, depending on how this exploratory block goes between Shell and Qatar Petroleum. President Hage Geingob has announced a launch of a long-awaited new government agency. Well, long-awaited by SWAPO and government bureaucrats, but not long-awaited by citizens, I'm sure of that. President Hage Geingob will launch a long-awaited Bureau for Tax, Law Enforcement, and Collection of Namibian Revenue Services Agency on Wednesday. This follows declaration in the Government Gazette 7496 of April 1st that the agency is now in operation as of April 6th. So he's going to announce it tomorrow, but it started today. Go figure. Finance Ministry spokesman Tonateni Shiduhu confirmed that the launch will take place at a local hotel in Windhoek. The event is set to also see the finance minister handing over power of revenue collection to his former colleague at the central bank, Sam Chivute, who was appointed the NAMRA commissioner last year. He said that over 1,200 staff members from the Inland Revenue Department and Customs and Excise Director are expected to be transferred to NAMRA. There you have it. So Namibia is finding a way to ostensibly improve its tax collection. We'll see if that's actually the case, folks. We will see if that's actually the case. But yet more government oversight, more government agencies in a country. Well, government oversight would be necessary, but a third party would be nice, given all the scandals taking place and alleged corruption in Namibia. That would be necessary. Perhaps you go after the bank accounts of these corrupt politicians who got money from an Icelandic fishing company. I'm just saying. It'd be a good place to start. Meanwhile, in Botswana, Salashando Dumelang, someone whom I rarely agree with, we find ourselves somewhat in accord over recent statements that Salashando made. Leader of opposition in Maun West MP Dumelang Salashando has expressed his displeasure at the extension of the state of public emergency by 6 months. Well, take a number, Rocco. Giving his response during a debate on the affirmation of emergency powers regulations tabled before the National Assembly by Vice President Slumber Tsokwane, he said an extensive state emergency was unnecessary as the Public Health Act could have sufficed. Well, on that we agree. Mr. Salashando said various clauses within the Public Health Act allowed the Director of Health Services to declare a state of public health emergency and to curtail movement through lockdowns or curfews, force people to test and partake in vaccination, as well as to enforce social distancing. Well, this is one of those rare instances in which Dumelang Salashando, I'm tired today. This is one of the rare instances in which Dumelang Salashando and I do agree on something. The state of emergency that was declared for another 6 months now takes Botswana out to 18 months in a state of emergency. That's not an emergency. That's normal. So something must be done. Something must be addressed here. But the Botswana Democratic Party is unassailed in parliament, and they'll do what they desire. This, of course, is a consequence of feckless, incompetent opposition in Botswana, who have missed three golden opportunities to unseat the Botswana Democratic Party in elections there. Three golden opportunities. The most recent one was the most disappointing for people who wanted to see a change in governance in Botswana. That's not to make any claims against the Botswana Democratic Party, which has done amazing work building a virtually destitute country with no roads, 16 kilometers of coal tarred surface roads in 1966. And taking the resource curse and avoiding it becoming something that became a pervasive corruption mechanism diamonds in particular, and turning it into a useful tool to enrich a country and raise it up to middle income status. Botswana Democratic Party has done amazing things. It's a country that works. Law enforcement is honest. The country is safe by and large. And it is a prosperous country for about half the population. The other half still lives on a pittance each day. But the country has come a long way under the Botswana Democratic Party. But it has become ossified. And its decisions seem to be more akin to the way the ANC behaves. Their decisions are based on loyalty, not on competence. And that's a concern. No other home. Refugees in Kenya camps devastated over closure. Kenya has given an ultimatum to the United Nations Refugee Agency to present a plan over the closure of the Dadaab and Kakuma camps, housing more than 400,000 people. Terrifying. Shocking. A rejection of humanity. These are just some of the words used by residents of Kenya's two largest refugee camps to describe their fear and despondency over the news that the government is trying to have their settlements shut down immediately. On March 24th, Kenyan Interior Minister Fred Matangai declared the United Nations Refugee Agency had 2 weeks to come up with a plan for closing the camps. Now, they won't close in 2 weeks, which has 410,000 people from more than a dozen countries, including Somalis, South Sudanese, Ethiopians, Tanzanians, Ugandans, and Burundians. Otherwise, authorities warned they would force refugees to travel to the border with Somalia. In a tweet, Kenya's interior minister called this an ultimatum and said there was no room for further negotiations. I don't know if the Kenyan government sat down and considered the lives of people living in the camp, or they just wake up and make those decisions, says Austin Bayoba, a South Sudanese living in Kakuma. Right now, the entire camp, the information has caused the panic, and very many people have lost hope. He's never known another home. He's lived in that refugee camp his entire 26 years of life. Listen, I appreciate that Kenya is concerned about these refugee camps. They're massive, 400,000, 410,000 people. But an ultimatum that they're going to force 410,000 people across the border into the desert of Somalia, when many of these people aren't even Somalis? That's just insanity. Is this just posturing, or is Nairobi this callous and insensitive? One has to wonder. Nairobi doesn't pay for these camps. The United Nations pays for these camps. They are a problem. They have been a source of religious trouble, and they've been a source of ethnic trouble. It's not exactly a paradise. But 2 weeks' notice to come up with a plan to close them, this could have been discussed years ago. Why is it only now being pushed forward? One has to wonder just how callous and uncaring officials are in Nairobi. Meanwhile, a manhunt is underway for 1,800 inmates after a brazen Nigeria prison attack. Assailants were heavily armed with assault weapons, rocket-propelled grenades, and improvised explosive devices. Wow. That is quite impressive. Attackers armed with machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades have launched a series of coordinated attacks in southeastern Nigeria, freeing more than 1,800 inmates from a prison. Attacks began at 2 in the morning in Owerri, a town in the state of Imo. Lasted for 2 hours, according to local resident Uche Okafor. Gunmen also assaulted other police and military buildings. Efforts are in top gear to rearrest the fleeing detainees, Nigerian prison spokesman Francis Inubore said, adding that 35 other inmates stayed behind during the prison break. I guess they didn't want to go. The coordinated attacks came less than 2 weeks after another wave of violence in southeastern Nigeria, when at least a dozen security officers were killed during attacks on four police stations, military checkpoints, and prison vehicles. No immediate claim of responsibility, but the Nigerian Inspector General of Police blamed the indigenous people of Biafra and its Eastern Security Network, a paramilitary wing of the secessionist movement active in the region. At this hour, this manhunt continues, looking for the escaped prisoners as well as the assailants who assaulted the prison there. Pretty crazy stuff. Pretty crazy stuff unfolding in Nigeria. 1,800 prisoners escaping. It is fascinating to find that 35 said, no, I'm not going anywhere. I'll just stay right here. Maybe these are people due to be released soon. Who knows? But wow. Nigeria's a big country, and this is not far from the border with Cameroon. People could have hightailed to Cameroon. Who knows? Very crazy what's happening there in Nigeria. 1,800 prisoners escaped after this coordinated assault. Rocket-propelled grenades, assault rifles. There's no such thing. AK-47s. Crazy stuff. Meanwhile, those with university degrees are living hand-to-mouth in Nigeria. This according to the Financial Times newspaper, which has the following to say. Most days, Clement Akinyue heads down to a market near his home in the northern city, Nigerian city of Kaduna, to sell shoes or domestic goods for local traders. A far cry from what he thought he'd be doing when he graduated with an operations management degree 5 years ago. The 24-year-old he graduated from university 5 years ago at the age of 19. What is he, a child prodigy? Or is it not a real degree? The 24-year-old makes a few thousand naira, $7 to $13 a day, but the work is irregular. I've applied for over 100 jobs since I graduated the Federal Civil Service, Civil Defense, Nigerian Customs Service, the National Oil Company, Federal Road Safety, even Nigerian prisons. He's lived on his own since he was 12 and put himself to university in Kaduna. Oh, well, there you go. Well done there. Well done to you, Clement. I'm impressed. To get work here is very, very hard for normal people unless you know someone. Akuni is one of millions of jobless young Nigerians, victims of an economic crisis that is driving up poverty and sowing insecurity across Africa's most populous country, which has just barely emerged from its second recession in 5 years. The unemployment rate has more than quadrupled since President Buhari took office to 33.3%. The more than 60% of the workforce that is under 34 years old has it even worse, with more than half, 53.4% of people aged 15 to 24 and 37% of those aged 25 to 34 unemployed. Nigeria pumps out hundreds of thousands of fresh university graduates each year, and millions more people lacking degrees enter an economy that cannot produce enough jobs to absorb them. And there you have, ladies and gentlemen, in a nutshell, the challenge that confronts Africa, the continent, as we approach 2050. The year 2050 will be a watershed decade for Africa, with 2.3 to 2.5 billion people living on the continent. Where will the jobs come from? With the median age of 14 years and 9 months in Niger, that means most of the population is very young. They haven't entered the workforce. They will enter the workforce. Uganda has a similar situation. Last time I checked, it was around 15 years plus, 15 years, 6 months or thereabouts is the median age. That's crazy. That compares with Ghana, which is 20 years and 7 months, a bit older. It compares with Western Europe, which is up into the 30s most likely, and here in the United States in the late 20s. Very young populations. Where will the jobs come from? That's a good question. And that's the headlines, news, and analysis for today, the 6th of April, 2021. Folks, thank you for listening to Indaba Africa.